process of meditation, there are a number of valuable and important features which take place. And there is a certain kind of construction. And what I mean by that is, there is the subject, and then there is the object. And life and the field of human experience is the relationship of the subject to the object, and of course, the subject to the subject. And in this relationship, there is much to be discovered. At times, for some people, there is difficulty in staying with this relationship and the wish to look outside of it for something other than, something metaphysical. Dharma teachings and practices endeavor to keep trust and faith in what can be found and discovered in this bare relationship of the subject to the object. The nature of the subject, that is you, that is me, certainly does change. So at times, the subject would say, I am sitting here. That means the subject is the whole person, this particular human being, and the object or objects is all that come to my senses. So the subject feels to be myself, who I am, and when I look out there at the world of objects, objects of human beings and buildings and much else, this seems and feels to be something which I am not. And this assumption of the subject is who I am, that the object is who I am not, is something which human beings carry as a very strong view. There is a great deal of conviction about, and perhaps rather sadly, it isn't questioned enough. And because there appears to be a widespread agreement, I am the subject, this is me, you are the object or objects, this is not me. Because of this agreement is so common, so frequently, and belongs to normal human discourse, we take it to be the reality, that really is the truth. Dharma teachings, with its curiosity, its meditations, its questioning, and our capacity to bring in a rather healthy doubt about the view. To take the normal view, I am the subject, you are the object, as a conventional view, to be quite comfortable and relaxed about it, but not to transfer into it as though that is the truth, that is the reality. It's a human agreement. It's a convention. It's a relative truth. It's a way of facilitating dialogue, etc. Our meditations, our mindfulness practices, such that it also starts to reveal a change, and it's rather an important change, and the change is that the object becomes closer to home, so to speak. So, as we see from the four applications of mindfulness of the Buddha, the initial is, there is the mindfulness, which means to be a conscious human being, to give attention to, and the object becomes an object close to home, so to speak. In this case, meaning the breath, or meaning the body. So the world around as the object is of less interest, less focus of attention, and that which initially was the subject, I am sitting here talking to you, breathing, I am feeling, I am experiencing my body, that changes because the mindfulness has now made the breath the object. The breath is the object of interest. And with the making of the breath the object of interest, it gives the opportunity, and it's an important one, for consciousness, which means mindfulness with some energy to it, it gives the opportunity for mindfulness so to speak, as the subject, to have a relationship with the object, which is called the breath, and to find a certain calm and steadiness in that bare subject-object relationship. It's an important process because in the steadiness of things, there is an opportunity to see more. And the same principle applies when our inner life is steady, when consciousness, that means to be conscious of, when consciousness of is steady, very steady, it will notice and see more because there are less interruptions, less waves, less ripples disturbing the view. When in our meditations we make breath as one object of interest, as I say, the mindfulness as the subject engages with the object called the breath, and that in that engagement with it, it has the potential to allow the whole body to relax, to be more steady and still, and correspondingly, because of the relationship to the subject, the mindfulness can become steady and still. It may require from us, and our experience has to determine this, how much effort we apply. An effort is a real skill. If we push too hard, if we force ourselves to try to be with the breath as an object for one breath after another, it will create a pressure in the psyche. It will create a pressure in the inner life, and the trying with any act of force or will actually disturb the relationship between the subject and the object. And so sometimes, with our mindfulness of the breath, yes, our mind wanders, and my God, can it wander, and all sorts of places. We are often very grateful that there is no technology yet for our minds to be projected on the large screen for everyone to see what's going on inside of it in a meditation. But you never know in next generation. So currently, there is the mindfulness of the object. And when the mind is wandering a lot, we might be feeling tired, we've got some doubts, I don't know what I'm doing here, not a lot of interest anywhere on the planet is better than Eindhoven, or whatever it might be. There can be the reaction against that, and it's going to be watchful for, and when we react against what we're experiencing, sometimes the willpower, which is not helpful, the willpower comes in and starts to put pressure on the subject to see more, to be with the breath. And the willpower, putting this pressure on the mindfulness, which is the subject, inhibits the opportunity for a harmonious, calm, clear relationship with the object because of the willpower. And sometimes we are concerned, but if I don't exert some willpower, then I'm just going to spend my time sitting, walking, standing, reclining, daydreaming, fantasizing, producing a load of stuff and nonsense, and which all will be very unhelpful. So I need my will to get focused. Oh, no, you don't. That's the one thing you don't need. What one needs is at times the quiet, careful, mindful application for a short period of a little effort to stay present, so that you're not creating a strain on the mindfulness, a pressure on the mindfulness, nor a strain in the body. There's enough strains in the body already. We don't want to add to them. So it may require, in our meditations, I have all four postures here in mind, sit, walk, stand, and recline, a quiet patience, a great virtue for all meditators. A quiet patience in which there is the interest, which is in a way another word for love really, but there's an interest in the dynamic and in the process of mindfulness with breath, meaning subject with object, the connection with that, and quietly through the process staying with that in order not just to be with it, but for two or three things. One is the actual staying with it, to be able to notice with the mindfulness, it's an important aspect of the Dharma here, to actually be noticing the changes that are going on with the breath. It's not just mindfulness of breathing. And in the very instructions of the Buddha, he says in the discourse, one is mindful of the breath when it is long, one is of the out-breath, and when it is short, when it's steep, when it's shallow. So when it's giving attention to the breath, and to see what the changes are that are going along with the contact with the breath. So it's mindfulness with seeing impermanence, mindfulness with different sensations, mindfulness with the body expanding a little differently on the in-breath and contracting a little differently on the out-breath, and really taking notice of that. The taking notice of that is important, not because it's the fact, only because it's the fact, but in the inner life, there is a wisdom which can develop inwardly and deeply, that we, without the effort, we get used to experiencing life, truly experiencing it, through the wisdom of noticing the changes that are going on. We get used to seeing the changes, we get used to living with the changes, and when we are living with them with the deep, we can adapt to life. And if you notice any problematic area of life, any problematic, no matter how large the scale or how small the incident, somewhere in the dynamic of problematic life, it will have some bearing on change. It has to. It can't be otherwise. It will, can either be, in the variations of the theme, it can be everything is changing too fast. This is the view. Another view can be things in my life are changing too slowly. Another view. Another view can be in my life nothing is changing. I'm stuck. I really want something to change. I really want something to be different from what it is. Another view can be, I really want something, it's so great, it's so wonderful, I just want it to stay as it is. It's just perfect. Like this. So every issue, every conflict, whatever is going on for us, somewhere in the event, it's about change. Either it's changing and I don't want it to change, it isn't changing and I want it to change. It's changing too fast. It's changing too slow. Yawn, yawn. You know what I mean. The quiet wisdom of not only being with the object called the breath or called the body or whatever it may be, the quiet wisdom of that dynamic is so that something is beginning to sink more deeply. Stephen was speaking to us a few moments ago, as he said, the coming home, sinking more deeply, that we really are conscious human beings who are deeply familiar with the processes of change. And our meditation practices do need to include, at the rather subtle level, the processes of change. But there's something equally important in our meditation practices as well. And that is, in the relationship to the object, the same principle equally applies to what I give attention to in, quote-unquote, my practice. So though it's very easy as a human being to, right now, shall we say, to sit here and say, well, right now, I am the subject, and you are the object, this is me, and you are not me. This is myself, you are not myself. And, you know, most people, probably best part of 7 billion, would say, yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, fairly obvious there. But then, I'm a meditator. I'm committed to mindfulness. I'm interested in concentrating on the object. I'm interested in the subject's relationship with the object. But I change the object. The object, what, plenty of the times, is what is going on out there in my so-called relationship to the object. But could it be that when the subject, called mindfulness, or being a conscious human being, makes the breath the object, maybe the breath is the same observation of an object, and one can put hands on one's heart and say, just as before, this breath is an object. Since it is an object of the subject, this is breath, it's not me. It's not mine. It's not who I am. How could it be? It's the object of interest. And just as I say that quite effortlessly and easily, you are not me, you are, I'm quoting the Buddha directly here, you are not me, you are not myself, you are not who I am. And an object cannot be who I am. The similar principle applies when I give attention to the breath. And the principle applies because I can look at the breath. I can experience it coming into consciousness. I can experience it going out. I can experience it long and short and deep and shallow. I can experience all that dynamic of that object. And so the object then cannot be the subject. Sometimes we reach the end of our, reach the end of our meditations. The end of the meditations, sitting, walking, standing and reclining, and other times as well, are rather important for the meditator. Because there's the moment of stopping. And of course, sometimes when one of the three of us are sitting here and waiting for the gong to ring, and sometimes I remember myself in the monk's days, sometimes the patience gets lower. You know, especially the last 5 or 10 minutes sometimes of a 45-minute or an hour-long meditation. So one starts off in the process with the sitting, and there's patience and preparation, there's giving interest in the object, there is making allowances for the wandering mind or some tiredness or whatever agitations. We quietly exercise the quiet discipline without the willpower just to come back to the present. And then a fresh object begins to replace the breath. Probably the most popular one in the hall is called pain in the knees, pain in the back, pain in the ankles, or just some energy dropping. Patience gets less and less. And when that gets less and less, some tension starts to arise. The waiting, if not the praying, for the end of the sitting. Even profound militant atheists start praying to God for the end of the sitting. So, when tension builds inside of us and tightening builds up inside, the object becomes the waiting and the tension. And when the object is the waiting and the tension, waiting for something to be over, remember it's the story of our life here, when we're waiting for something to be over and finished, it creates a pressure because there is tension in the relationship of the subject to the object. Sometimes the last 10 to 15 minutes of a sitting meditation is the most important 10 or 15 minutes of your life. I know it doesn't feel like that, but you get the point. So, Dharma as a liberation movement, remember, is to allow, it's a great challenge, but as a liberation movement of life, it is to allow the free movement of life, because life is a free movement, without the pressure of the subject on the object. When the pressure is not on the object, situations, environments, the object called the breath, the object called my state of mind, the object called the body, when there isn't pressure upon there, and that pressure is dissolving, life has the opportunity to really move more freely through the processes. We have an important, if that is what liberation is about, which I would say what it is about, it's an authentic liberation known through experience, then part of our exploration and part of our inquiry and our meditation is then to ask ourselves, where in life do I place the most pressure? Where does it show itself? Who am I placing pressure upon? Am I placing pressure upon the object, called people and places and etc.? Am I placing pressure upon the object, called breath, called body? Am I placing pressure upon the subject, what I want, what I must have, what I must need? And that kind of pressure generates for us the stress. So we need to know ourselves rather well. And coming back to the patience point for a moment or two, the patience, such as the end of the sitting or periods of tiredness, that patience is learning to be with the process and to see if we can allow the voice inside, the reactive voice, which is the hard voice, to soften. And we notice, I can notice in myself, and perhaps sometimes you do as well, when the willpower comes in, which is the action of the self, of the ego, when the demand comes in that very demand we're placing upon our self, which is the subject, upon the other, which is the object, the demands that we place upon ourselves or on the others stop us from being at home with life. It makes a terrible gap. It fragments subject and objects. It makes the divisions. And part of our practice and exploration is to really recognize where are the demands on the retreat, where I'm placing the pressures on myself, the demands on myself. And can I find within the forms, sitting, walking, standing, reclining, a way of being where I'm deeply interested in the subject-object relationship, and I'm especially vigilant and especially watchful of where the demands come in. Because those demands, more than anything, is exhausting. Those demands are resisting, are resistance. And we have to find a way to allow life to move more easily and freely through the reduction and the dissolving of the resistance and the demands. Our whole life of the subject, and the object is the field where we work. It's the laboratory, and much can be discovered. In the meditations, finally, when you are engaged in the meditations, and just exploring the meditations, the periods of time, and this is where we come to the end of the sitting for some reflection, and the reflection I regard as a very important aspect here, to use the end of a sitting or the end of a walking for a little reflection, to actually look back over the period, half an hour, 45 minutes, and to see how was the general sense of one's relationship, subject-object, to that process. If something was standing out, maybe standing out was you feeling clear and comfortable with the meditation. Look back over the meditation and one feels satisfied that, generally speaking, one's interest, and there was some harmony of subject and object, such as breath or body or whatever, one feels that, just acknowledge that and appreciate that. But for God's sake, don't draw any conclusions or get ambitious. Otherwise, you're up something creek. If you know the English, you know what I mean. So, what I mean by that is, there is the recognition at the end of a sitting, walking period. One might say, this was a valuable sitting. This was a helpful sitting. I really feel I'm settling in. When people say to me, oh, Christopher, it takes me 2 or 3 days to settle in. We haven't got that long. We've only got today. So when there is a sense of settling in, and generally speaking, not perfectly, general interest in the breathing, body is okay, being a conscious human being in the present, not a lot of struggle or fighting going on, really feeling present, to acknowledge that at the end of the sitting, to appreciate that at the end of the sitting or the walking there, but not to grab hold of it. Because if one grabs hold of it, you will carry the expectation, in my next sitting or my next walking, I'm going to take off from where I was. And there's no faster way to corrupt that view by clinging to the past experience. Because we will end up in the nightmare of comparing. And even if the next meditation was absolutely out of this world, you're completely knocking on the door of total enlightenment and liberation, and that would make the Buddha jealous. And that might be for the next generation, but there will be some almighty crash along the way. So we reflect on the last meditation. We look back. What was the quality of this meditation like? Recognize it. It's a clear judgment, quiet statement about it. And then we carry on with our life. If it's not like that, it's one of those meditations with the hellishness inside of it. There's painful story, a distressing situation, worries, terrors and anxieties are going on. And, oh God, and finally the bell has been rung, it's a liberation in itself. And one's just gone through an incredibly difficult period in the meditation, sitting, walking, whatever. That moment for the reflection is to be clear and honest about it, and if possible, to name, part of the Buddha Dharma of mindfulness of states of mind, to name simply and directly what was that mind state. How would you describe it? Was it anger? Was it fear? Was it agitation? Was it restlessness? Was it terrible pains in the body? Was it obsessive thinking? So one comes to the end of the meditation, one turns the eye back over the period of time, looks where this meditation seemed to be mostly or all about this in a problematic way, And the reason for the naming and determining of what it is that that naming and determining means that when you go, or when we go into the next meditation, we want to be extremely vigilant to see if we can catch the re-arising of that mind state early. So it may have completely consumed the last meditation. We've named it. It was this. We bring that simple concept into the next meditation. We engage in our meditation practice, subject, object, mindfulness of breathing or body, whatever it is. And we're particularly alert and vigilant and careful to see the first murmurings of that past problematic mind state, and to see whether, without the willpower, once again, we can quietly, in a relaxed way, stay focused on our primary object. And therefore, each meditation in the four postures really can be a valuable resource for quiet reflection of what was before, there, being honest and truthful with what was before, moving on with one's life, and when the next formal meditation comes in, which, as I, to repeat a little bit, that mind state which we have named, that's the one that we have to be careful about. Yeah. Finally, I did a finally a minute or two ago, I'll do one more finally, there, that in the teachings and the practices, some of you, with your lovely experiences in the world of processes and meditations, there have, generally speaking, a quality of being at ease with the day, and there is a well-being and genuine happiness to be here. There is no wish to be anywhere else, and it's a genuine deep feeling this is the right place to be during these days. And as Stephen was reminding us a few minutes ago of noble silence, and how in a real way it gives support to everybody. That feeling of being at home with has rather profound significance, and Stephen's touching upon this, and I just want to give the reminder. Our normal sense of being at home is home where we live, that place. So Leela was telling us, very touching to listen to, her period of 2 or 3 days with Bernie Glassman and being out on the streets with the poor and the homeless. And for a couple of nights, this was her home, out there on the streets. And then we have our home, wherever that place may be, long-term or short-term. I've lived in the same home now for 32 years in one of those instantly forgettable English streets. But nice street, actually. But this is the convention. Then sometimes we will say to ourselves or to others, oh, home is where our heart is. This is a very nice poetic one-liner. So a place where we love to be. Oh, I really feel at home. And when I arrived here at Eindhoven, and the joy of coming here, being back in Israel and coming there, actually, when I arrived and got out of the car, first word that came out was home. Because I have a nice, loving, homely feeling about being here, and a real delight to be here. So sometimes home is where the heart is at the time. But we could go a little bit deeper, because we're women and men of the earth. Sometimes in the deeper, we can say, our home is where our feet are. Our home is where the soles of our feet are. And we can feel really at home wherever we are. whatever country, whatever house, indoors or outdoors, we just feel at home. We feel at home with life. We feel at home with the events of existence. We feel at home. It's a very precious and beautiful sense and feeling. But would that be going deep enough? To really feel at home and just be at home where our feet are with all of that? What would it be to explore deeply into the nature of the subject and object? So that even when we're at home where our feet are, as the object for the subject, just walking, we're at home where our feet are, even in that subject-object relationship, precious and beautiful there, could the subject and object of the small step actually being give us the opportunity to realize where our home really is? Enough. Let's have a quiet minute together, shall we? Beings, explore the relationship of subject to object, object to subject. All beings, look deeply into the relationship to life. All beings, come to infinite discoveries and infinite realizations about what we live with.